and welcome to edition 383 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Dejan Sujic, the director of the soon-to-be-opened Design Museum in London and also author of The Language of Cities.
Then we'll be discussing the latest project of Italian photographer Mimi Malika, a personal project about the influence of the mafia in his homeland, Sicily.
And we'll also be hearing from Paola Zuccotti, well known for her photographs of everyday lives through objects. But this time she created an imaginary day of the presidential candidates in this year's election, Clinton versus Trump.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan will be here for the news look ahead. And we're going to enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, we made it to Sunday, Andrew. Here we are.
Well, you've only just made it. You've still you've had floozy.
I'm feeling a little bit pale and interesting. I'm sorry you have to share studio time with me.
No. It was very nice of you to come in your gym jams with your little dressing gown on.
The thermometer under my arm. Do people still do that?
Yeah, they stick it elsewhere as well. But under the arm is the best place, especially if you're sharing
best place for the office, I thought. Okay. But anyway, yeah, so it's been a bit of a lethargic home-based week for me.
I know, poor thing.
But in the office, everything has been ticking along. I don't know, like what? Like a kind of, I don't know, like a well-oiled machine? What sort of machine would it be if it were a well-oiled machine?
I think it's been ticking along like some explosive devices under your desk, actually, personally. It's been a bit threatening this week. Too many things going on.
A lot of things.
Yeah, we finished December, January issue. Forecast about to come out. Two new city guides are out, as I think I've mentioned before, Los Angeles and Copenhagen.
That was a nice treat to come home to. We've done a lot of work this year when I'm getting the two places that I basically ferry myself between confused. Nice thing to come back into the office to, Copenhagen and LA guides. Right?
All staff got their little book pile. Yeah. And then we've got Toronto coming out, and then we're finishing pretty Christmas come out in the new year. We're finishing Berlin as we speak. So lots going on. But
we've got some time to squeeze in some radio, haven't we?
Yeah, we've got some time for old Radioville, including, should we wheel in the little man himself?
If we must.
It's Henry Rees Sheridan. Henry, oh Henry, hey. Love the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, love the way he takes his hop. But how am I doing now? Hello, Henry.
Wheel in the little man.
It's funny, isn't it? Funny.
That's not
say.
A euphemism.
I should hope not.
Off you go.
Thanks. So, obviously, there is one event this coming week which overshadows all other planned events. I'm talking, of course, of the United States of America's election.
Oh no, I thought it was going to be something great, like a tractor race.
All right.
Okay.
You thought I was going to do a bait and switch.
Yeah.
Now, I thought that we could celebrate the election on the weekly by having a look at people's plans of what they're going to do on election night. And I'm going to begin with the two candidates themselves. Have you read anything about...
No, I don't know. Plan-
so I'll begin with...
I haven't prepared on purpose.
So you can have an organic reaction.
Yes, exactly.
So Hillary is going to be celebrating her night at the Jacob K. Javits Center on the west side of Manhattan. And this particular building has a important architectural feature which ties into the symbolism of her potential election. Either of you guess what that might be?
It's got an internet server in the basement.
I presume it does, but it also has the largest glass ceiling in New York.
Oh, very nice. Okay.
So she's going to be celebrating there. Donald Trump is going to be celebrating at the New York Hilton Midtown Hotel Ballroom.
Has it got a thatch roof?
I'll have to look into that. I cannot confirm or deny that it has a thatched roof.
Well, the funny though, they're only going to be like minutes away from each other on the night.
They are, yeah, exactly. And one thing that I find interesting too is obviously there's a kind of Schrodinger's cat situation with, you know, you have to plan for a celebration and the commiseration at the same time. And there's a Washington Post article which notes that Mitt Romney spent $25,000 on fireworks that never went off.
Oh, that's great.
Back when he lost to President Obama in 2012. There's also a note that says Trump hasn't planned any fireworks because, according to a spokesperson, he's superstitious and doesn't want to jinx things. So a little insight into his reasoning there, which we can take note of. It's not too late to try and encourage
people. I love that. That's good.
I'd love to see the receipt for those fireworks and them being taken back to the shop.
Yeah.
The person whose job it was to drive the van of fireworks back to the shop.
Take them back to the off license on the corner. Yeah. Exactly.
That's good, isn't it?
And then there was an excellent article in the Wall Street Journal last week looking at the fraught nature of private individuals attempting to throw regular celebration parties for election night, but feeling that this year was so polarised, so full of strong feelings that they could not go along according to their normal plans, or had to make a point of acknowledging how vociferously people feel. Does that make sense? Vociferously people feel?
Yeah, exactly.
About things. So Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government alumni are holding a party in San Francisco called Champagne or Cyanide, It's Election Night.
Right. I know which side I'm on.
A fiction writer in Los Angeles called Jenna Nelson plans to have fake Canadian passports made in the event of Trump winning. And there's a tragic story about a couple who for years have hosted their own election nights where traditionally they've baked elephant and donkey-shaped cookies for their friends and family to gather around and consume while watching the election. But as you can see from this picture, have had to take a non-partisan alternative this year.
Sorry, what am I looking at? Oh, the top one.
The top one. And just star-shaped.
Why couldn't they do donkeys and...
Because the emotions are running so high.
Because they hate each other so much.
Even the sight of the shapes of the party emblems rendered in cookie form could have instigated some kind of conflict.
Wow.
So I think that really is a kind of a telling sign of where we're at. But I wonder, you know, Monocle obviously has an interest in hospitality and hosting
and
events.
Cookies.
And cookies, indeed. I wonder if you have any tips for people
that
they might follow.
Don't make us say that phrase.
No?
Don't make me say it.
No. Whatever it is, don't say it. No tips. But let's just say the next day we're going to have a full team of people here early in the morning doing full election results. And so join Monocle 24 on the day and the day after, because we'll be making sense of whatever happens.
We'll be making sense. You always put the wrong inflection on that, because we'll be making sense.
For once. And I wonder, historically, have you two stayed up for UK or US elections?
Yeah.
Is it something
yes.
you have? For both?
Yes.
Yeah. Are you going to watch
the
this
US
time
election? I mean, that won't even start happening until sort of.
Well, exactly. I'm wondering
with the time difference.
No, apparently, by the European time, like roughly at 3 a.m, which way the wind is blowing.
I think when Obama was inaugurated, I had an American girlfriend at the time. I think that was quite fun. That was a party.
In Britain?
Yeah.
Yeah, you said that. I actually remember staying up, believe it or not.
I baked some starfish.
Sorry?
I baked some starfish that night, I can tell you.
Did you? I hope they tasted good. And I've only ever attended one election party in my life, and that was the 1997 Labour landslide. I was okay. 6, and I stayed up all night watching Jon Snow's swingometer. And I have photo proof of this, which unfortunately, because of the constraint of the medium, I'm not going to be able to show listeners.
How sweet.
Because of Operation U-Tree, you're not allowed to tell us.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay.
That's... I'm not going to pretend otherwise. That's all I had lined up for today,
that's
guys.
That's amazing. I think that's on point.
Yeah, you've done very,
funny,
very well,
lots
Henry.
Of good research.
Thanks,
good
Rob.
Stuff.
Thanks.
On the 24th of November, the Design Museum in London will open in a new venue where the Commonwealth Institute in Kensington used to be.
The man responsible for the Design Museum spoke to Andrew about the museum and also about his new book, The Language of Cities. Here is Dejan Sujic.
Dejan, let's start with the most basic question, which your new book does answer. What is a city?
On one level, a city is anything from a town called Hope, where Bill Clinton was born, with a population of about 10,000, which would fill the lower third of a New York skyscraper, or it's Tokyo with probably 40 million people, 250,000 civil servants, and a budget the size of Switzerland. A city is a place in which people can be themselves. A successful city is a place which offers choices.
Now, when we look at, as outsiders, at cities, we're tempted to look at, you know, the buildings, you know, the density, the way that the roads carve through, which are certainly important. But you say that you can't really understand any city without understanding the people. It's the people that that really define the city.
What makes a city cohere is that sense of belonging to it. And I think that there's something much more generous about the idea of a city identity than national identity, which is probably a more recent concept and one which somehow seems more about telling people they don't belong, whereas a city is based on people coming to it and sharing that sense of identity and purpose, feeling they're part of something. And the things that make that sense of belonging, even as a city gets larger and larger, like Tokyo, for example, which is bigger than most European countries, is those signs and signals that people recognize. It's the language that people speak. So cities develop their own distinctive speech patterns. German in Berlin is not the same as German in Hamburg. London English keeps adapting to reflect who lives here and the new groups that have joined it for a long time. Jews from Eastern Europe inflected the rhythms of Cockney. More recently, the Caribbean has made its presence felt. That language shifts, but it's still very much a London identity. And then some of the things can be really quite banal. Londoners know that NW10 means something very different from SW3, but these are the strange landmarks of the 19th century post office intended to make deliveries easier, and yet they take on a social purpose as well.
The book unpacks all the elements you need to build a city, from naming your city to city governance. Why did you think this book was needed to do that? Did you feel that it was in the dissembling of the parts that you could finally understand the whole? Because, as you say, cityness is something that is always changing, evolving. Did you feel this was a good time to pick apart all those elements to find out what makes our cities tick?
I've been fascinated by cities ever since I started walking around London as a child, where I was born. And over the years, I've thought about them. I've visited a lot of cities, and I've written more than one book about them. And this one really was a distillation. I had a great editor at Penguin, Helen Conford, who, when we were talking about what the book could be, simply said, look, think about five or six questions that really are at the heart of the matter. So in the past, I've spent a long time looking and observing, and this book is an attempt to try and crystallize a few thoughts about what are those essential aspects. It's the banal, obvious things, like a name. It's how you navigate a city. It's how you convey a city in fiction or in film. And it's about how people live in it.
And tell me, the notion of this cityness, you look at a few points where in contemporary times, the notion of how you build a city, how you change a city have been very evident. For example, here in London, you look at the case of Docklands, and can cities be suddenly built, or are all good cities actually? Because you do look at the quality of cities as well, which is a very nice element of the book. And you say that often in the past, critics have said, actually, it's only cities that naturally grow like a tree that really have, you know, this proper city vibe. But when you looked at the example of Docklands, what do you think they did there that was right and wrong? Because it's still a part of London that many Londoners feel detached from. Even though you go there, there is, you know, certainly life. It feels separate from our city even now.
We like to believe there's such a thing as an organic city, a free-range city, something that grows out of a semi-natural phenomenon. Of course, that's always a delusion. Cities are man-made. They are artificial, just as landscape is mostly man-made now as well. But you can plan cities in more successful ways, in some cases, than others. Quite often, cities grow as the result of unintended consequences. Docklands in London now is the product of a lot of things, but the thing that really triggered it was the invention of a piece of really low-tech kit, the standard shipping container, back in the late 1950s. That was meant to make shipping cheaper and to stop shrinkage, as it was called, of cargoes. And it had the effect, of course, of wiping out every upstream dock around the world, because it meant ships were too big to get into the old docks, which meant that Canary Wharf, once the busiest port in Britain, probably Europe too, was wiped out in 10 years. What do you do with it? Do you turn it into a park, as Greater London Council thought was the only possible option, or do you try and turn it into something else? Initially, the idea was that you could somehow make it into a business park, like something on the edge of Milton Keynes, and there was a set of incentives written to try to persuade people to do that. And then suddenly one banker realised that those incentives could be used to create high-rise office towers, and suddenly all bets were off. So we had this completely unintended mushrooming of towers. Initially, of course, it is the urban equivalent, I suppose, of a digital, very simple digital machine. Initially, a computer is an on or off switch, just as a city is a space or a building. But once the thing gets so complicated, and that's what's happened to Canary Wharf, it starts to leap out of the control of any one intelligence. So now what was once an office district at Canary Wharf, surrounded by a very deprived part of London, has become a magnet at weekends. It's got a transport system, housing is being built there, and suddenly this initially controllable entity, something that belonged to one property company, has become this pulsating bit of cityness, not a traditional city, but something that's actually got those elements to it.
When the story of Docklands began, and just to follow up on this, there, a gentleman called Paul Reichman was behind much of the development there, and there was a sense that here was an individual, you know, who was in charge of reshaping a big city. He was in charge of a large chunk of land and he was going to develop it. But are you saying that actually with hindsight, or that we should just be a little bit more relaxed about it because this organic nature, the tendrils of the rest of the city will encroach upon what anybody does, whether it's in, you know, it's in Seoul or in London, these bits of the city will be pulled back into the whole at some point?
Cities don't always work. You can look at failures around the world. You can look back to ancient times when the Mughals built Fatehpur Sikri as the capital of their growing state and ran out of water within a decade and abandoned a very beautiful city. You can look at Detroit, which began as an inland harbour on one of the Great Lakes in 1920, was building 90% of the world's cars and now isn't. And you can compare that with Turin, the Italian motoring capital, which also lost much of its car industry, but still has managed to renew and reinvent itself. Some cities seem to have within them the seeds of continually changing, of finding new futures, new economies, and others don't. And that's a mixture of many things. It's having people with vision and calculation. It's about political systems. It's about land holdings. It's about climate. It's about natural resources. It's a whole range of things. Developers, and Paul Reichman was one of the most famous and, for a while, the most successful, are very ambivalent. Sometimes when you talk to them, they give the impression that they are about cold, calculating logic and reason. And yet anyone who builds anything is also driven by ego, by making a monument, by doing something that other people can't do.
Well, I think you've given me a nice introduction to the second part of our conversation, because talking of building things, you're also in charge of the new design museum, the moved design museum, which has moved to West London here in the UK. It's taking over the old Commonwealth Institute, an amazing building from the 1960s. And you're in charge of that whole institution. Tell us about the move and how significant you think it is for design in the UK.
I was hired unbelievably 10 years ago with a brief to grow the design museum and to move it. It was founded by Terence Conran and Stephen Bailey, originally inside the Victoria and Albert Museum, in a bid to remind what had become the world's greatest museum of decorative arts, the V&A, that its roots were also in mass production and looking towards the future. So the Boiler House project lasted for 3 years. It was a snow-white basement in the V&A, and it was filled with exhibitions on how to design a Ford, branding Coca-Cola, Issey Miyake, all things which in those days seemed slightly transgressive within what the V&A then was, but I think it actually has had an amazing effect on transforming the way the V&A sees itself and presents things. But after that initial period, the Design Museum moved off to a converted banana ripening warehouse in Shad Thames, transformed into a kind of Bauhaus on Thames with white walls and flat roofs. Stephen and Terence initially wanted the Prince of Wales to open it. They went to see him with a model of the building, which is a bit of a mistake because he said, why does it have to have a flat roof? And so in the end, Mrs. Thatcher opened it. But as Terence says, now that we've gone to the Commonwealth Institute, which has this amazing concrete shell roof, at least we've solved the flat roof problem. So I was asked, the trustees had decided it was time to try to grow the museum. We had 3,000 square metres in the old building, and we had about 250,000 visitors a year. And it was lively and energetic and full of people, but there was a sense that we could do more, that we could grow, that we could add things to what we had. So we went looking for a new building or a new building site. We talked to the Tate about doing something behind the Turbine Hall. We looked at going back to the V&A. We looked at King's Cross. And then finally, we were offered the chance to take on the by now redundant Commonwealth Institute, a Grade 2 star listed building from 1962, which I remember vividly as a child. It was like a miniature World's Fair in which all 54 Commonwealth member states had their own little display. So the Canadians had a snowmobile and an Inuit totem pole. The Sri Lankans rather regrettably shot a tiger and stuffed it for their display. The Australians went into the finer points of sheep shearing, and it was charming. And in a way, utopian. It was one of the earliest modern buildings of its time in London. But the roof leaked furiously, and the Commonwealth decided they had better things to do. So bringing it back to life was a fantastic challenge, but a great opportunity, something that you feel personally engaged with if you actually remember the building as it was. And we'll get now 10,000 square metres, and we're planning on 650,000 visitors a year. And we offer, I think, a range of things. Yes, we have a strong exhibitions programme, but there's also studio space for young designers. There's an auditorium. There's an event space. There's a permanent collection open free of charge for the first time, as well as our paying exhibition programme. And it's a place about ideas as well as things.
Do you think we are good at understanding design? You know, art is one of those things that, you know, many people feel that you need to have a certain kind of knowledge to go into an art museum. But, you know, whether you wear sneakers or whether you're interested in fashion or whether you're interested in the mobile phone in your pocket, all of these things have been brought into the world of the design museum. You've been, in the past, it's been very good at not saying what's highbrow and lowbrow. It's embraced design in a really interesting way. Does that make it a very interesting conversation to have with all sorts of people who may otherwise be nervous of these kinds of institutions or may not want to walk through the front door?
Well, museum is a loaded word. I think museums actually do have a future because they are a shared social experience. You need a reason to switch your screen off and go and do something with other people. But you're right. Design, as I've always thought, is a way to understand the world around us. And what makes design so interesting is that it never stands still. In the early days of the Design Museum, you could have told a plausible account of the development of design by a selection of well-chosen chairs. You'd start with a Bentwood Cafe chair from Thonet, and you'd end up by way of the Bauhaus tubular steel to something made out of plastic. And yes, people still love chairs and people still want to see them, and we will have some chairs. But it's clear that we now live in a world in which an interface is as much a piece of design as an object is. We've gone through the age of mass extinctions through the analog to digital switch, all those things that we once proudly possessed and kept to show our personal histories, radios, cameras, typewriters, they've all gone, they've all vanished. And a museum like ours, I suppose, is really reflecting on what that means, what it does to us, how those phenomena are replaced by other things.
Well, Dejan, thank you so much for coming to see us. We look forward to visiting the Design Museum, and Dejan's new book is called The Language of Cities. Time for some new music now. Let's listen to LA duo Midnight to Monaco. That's not a bad journey to go on. And their new track, One Way Ticket. Baby, come on over. We can just pretend. Get a one-way ticket. California rent. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not telling you a lie. Get a one-way ticket. Come back. Don't say goodbye.
That was Midnight to Monaco with One Way Ticket, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
see that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Italian photographer Mimi Malika's new project is a very personal one to him, as it talks about his homeland of Sicily, and more specifically, its relationship with the destructive Cosa Nostra.
Mimi is here to talk about his upcoming book, Terra Nostra, which has taken 7 years to make. Mimi Malika, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Now, first of all, I met you many, many years ago, and you've been documenting your home territory of Sicily for all that time. Tell us why it's so important for you to give your version of your home island.
Well, before me establishing if it's important or not, I felt an urge more than anything. So if it's important or not, we will be able to establish it later, once the story will be digested from many people. And it's not down to me to say if it's important or not, but I definitely felt this urge. And this is an urge that started, you know, after 13 years that I was living abroad in London. I wanted to reconnect somehow with Palermo, with Sicily, and also wanted to identify some of the reasons why I left. This was really, really important for me. So this story is somehow a crossbreed between a documentary on the effects, the signs of the presence of Cosa Nostra in the island, but it's also a personal journey back to a Sicily that I needed to reconnect with.
So many photographers use the strangeness of their surroundings to find that perfect, the territory where the interest lies, I suppose, to shoot with a stranger's eye, is to sort of encapsulate maybe a lot of the viewer's idea of a place. But you obviously are doing something different. You're going and I wonder if you're trying to find the boyhood home, or whether you're noticing the differences between the man and the boy.
Absolutely. I always do. I make of this internal conflict my own very reason of living. First of all, you picked on something very interesting, the outsider perspective. And the outsider perspective is, first of all, the perspective implicit in any photographer. You cannot photograph unless you have some sort of distance from the subject. Otherwise, you wouldn't even feel the need to photograph or to tell that tale. So this is paramount, first of all. And then I grow up. I don't want to say I'm getting old, but, you know, I'm over 40 years old now, 41 years old, in fact. And I do enter in a pretty funny, sometimes dramatic dialectic between my younger self and myself now. And it's both personal and intimate. And also it's something that can be, it translates, it projects onto how I see what I see. And the fact that I've been living abroad for such a long time, I've been living now in London for over 20 years, going back to a place that to some degrees I still call home, it's a journey. It's a very intense journey. In fact, you know, Sean O'Hagan is writing one of the texts to the book. Sean O'Hagan is the Guardian critic on photography and music. And he said something very interesting on this conflict, that possibly the pursuit to search your home becomes home itself.
How do you bring that to life in photographs then?
This has been 7 years' work, not because I intended this to last for so long, but because it's been a real chess game It's been really difficult to use some cliché, avoid some others, turning the tables and finding out about my own demons, and trying to organize and photograph first and then organize a sequence of images that could somehow give you hints and never tell the whole story, but give you hints and make you think and give you reference and make you wonder about what I am suggesting. It's a real mixture between hard facts proofs and evocative imagery. But the sequencing of the book, I think I can comfortably say that leads the viewer to have a clear idea.
There's a really arresting video. I guess it's one of the images that's going to be in your book, of an old man waiting at a bus stop or somewhere in Palermo, and you talk us through how you shot that picture. And I guess it might give our listeners an indication of how tough it was to shoot that whole book. The fact that you can't just walk around with a camera shooting people, going up to people and shooting them. You have to be secret. You have to be subtle. This guy looks like he might have what we call in England a Chelsea smile. Right? So tell us about taking that picture.
Poor guy. I mean, that guy, he probably doesn't know that he's like a world sensation now. You know? But okay, first of all, this is my philosophy of photographing as candidly, you know, scenes that I see, I tend not to interact too much. But sometimes I do interact and I see nothing wrong, but my own personal approach is the one that I...
You don't want to leave your own imprint on the image?
Yes, I want to photograph what I see. And when I saw this guy, I was taken, how do you say...
Taken aback.
Yeah, taken aback from his haunted figure, or haunting figure. And I said, oh, God, I'm going to do this photograph. Now, I photograph with an old Hasselblad, which means that I have 12 shots in a roll. I have an external light meter, and the camera is quite big. So it's not as immediate as, I don't know, a phone or a digital point and shoot. So I took the measurement, I judged the right settings on the camera, I judged the focus, I looked at him, I looked at the camera, I turned, I pointed, chuk, 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 chuk. I think 3 shots that I've done. And because the Hasselblad, on the Hasselblad, you look downwards, you know, you don't look straight at the person because you have to look down on
the viewfinder, yeah.
You can see that the guy is looking at me, but he's not looking through the lens, but he's actually looking at me. And he's probably wondering, what the hell am I doing there? Why am I turning with this big thing? So anyway, he was a bit, you know, he was frozen. So I immediately went to him and I said, listen, can I take a closer portrait of you? And he said, no. I said, why not? Because I'm nervous. Said, right. Why are you nervous? Because I'm waiting for the bus. Ah, okay.
Oh, that bus.
And then, yes. Yeah. And these guys, somehow, you know, yesterday I woke up this morning.
He doesn't look that nervous, by the way. People will be able to see this in Terra Nostra, your book, Mimi. But he looks maybe like he might make you nervous.
Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Doesn't he, Andrew?
Yeah, he's...
It might be, you know, but these are the things that you never know. I mean, it's... Where does a moment stops and gives way to... the moment of the creation of the photograph and my interaction, my presence changing things. But then again, is that change that I'm looking for, right? I don't know.
First of all, just quickly tell us when the book will actually come out, because it's
December 2016.
Okay, perfect. And then tell me, it will then have a journey when it goes back to Sicily without you to be standing by its side explaining every image. Are you nervous what your friends, your family, even people you don't know in Sicily will make of this book when they open it? Or do you feel you're pretty confident that you have caught a fair portrait of your home?
I don't think there is a fairness in anything that regards artistic endeavours. I am not there to please anyone, and I'm not here to draw a mathematical statistic of any... datas. I'm offering my perspective on something that is objectively destructive of an entire nation, in fact. It's a difficult, very difficult issue. And all of my friends, actually, all of my friends and people that I know and family, they all been and they will carry on being extremely supportive, I know, because they supported me for 7 years, if not more. And they share my same view. And this is good. But will I encounter controversy as I go forward and as I go closer to Sicily? Maybe yes, maybe not. I don't know. I hope to a degree that I will, because otherwise my book would have meant nothing for no one. But I want this degree to be really limited, you know. I don't know. I don't know. It's a risk. I've been thinking, you know, one day Zygmunt Bauman, the philosopher, sociologist, I showed to him the very first batch of photographs back in 2010, I think, 2009, 2010. And he said, ah, Mimi, they are beautiful. They are so powerful, these images. But tell me, are you not scared? I said, why should I be scared? I'm not taking pictures of the mafia. I'm taking pictures of what mafia did. And he said, this is what I meant. And I said, oh, my God. He's a philosopher. He's not a stupid guy, you know. I hope he's wrong.
The mafia quite like having their photographs taken.
No. This is not. Mafia is not like Camorra,
no.
Or is not like the criminal gangs of the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. Mafia is still very, very secretive, and quite rightly so. I mean, why would you want to appear anywhere
in that ebb and flow of the power of the mafia? Within Sicily, do you feel that they are losing ground, or that they have just changed and they will exist for many, many years to come as a powerful entity in Sicily?
Well, mafia has definitely changed. It's changed radically, actually. It's changed because of financial reasons and financial opportunities as well. So, for instance, the narcotraffic is not anymore in the hands of Cosa Nostra much. It's more in the hands of 'Ndrangheta in Calabria, no? But also new opportunities have opened up to Cosa Nostra. And the business of the renewable energy is something where they poured in immediately. The financial markets are where they launder the money, for instance. So mafia has really changed a lot. And it's not anymore as it used to be back in the 70s and 80s during the Second War of Mafia, when the Corleonesi were fighting to take over the traditional mafia families in Palermo. So there is not much blood at all. There isn't much noise anymore. But there is still a presence that you feel for, because you cannot avoid it, because it's in the tomato that you buy every day to eat, or in the beach that is overshadowed by illegal building speculations. But it's not something that you perceive like in the movies or like in what it used to be before. Anyhow, Giovanni Falcone, the judge killed by mafia in 1992, did say something that is very true, I think. And it's mafia, it's a human phenomenon. And as such, it does have a beginning, and he will certainly have an end. And I truly believe so, because we live in a world that is in constant evolution, and things, they born and they die.
On that note, Mimi Mollica, thank you very much for your time. And the book, Terra Nostra, is out in the middle of December, right?
Yes, we are going on print on mid-November, then to the boundaries, and then Dawie Lewis will make it available to everyone in mid-December.
And tell me, if people want to give you more money, where can they, for now, head to find out about your fundraising?
The fundraising has finished yesterday, but still people is
welcome to give you money.
Yes, more than welcome to pre-order and send me an email. You know, you'll find me, mimimollica.com. It's not difficult.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week. With me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
And finally, on today's show, we look at the objects that define the two candidates in the upcoming US election, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
And we're going to talk to Paola Zuccotti, well known for her book, Everything We Touch, a series of photographs of everyday lives through objects. This new project is called Everything We've Heard. And Paola Zuccotti joins us in the studio. Paola, welcome to the programme.
Yes.
And here we are. We are nuzzled none more closely up against the US election. And you brought in some absolutely beautiful plan view photographs. Now, people that know what Everything We Touch was will be familiar with the photographic style of this, but let's not put the cart before the horse. So maybe tell us a little bit about, or tell our listeners a little bit about what Everything We Touch was and what they can expect from this new project.
Everything We Touch is a book that I published last year with Penguin Random House, and the book tells the story of 62 people around the world told by their physical footprint. So everything they touch in a day. So it reveals a person just by looking at their belongings and the things they use, the things they treasure, the things they love.
So you have iPhones, toasters,
exactly.
Belts.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
And it has everything. And also it has the objects that are starting to disappear. Like you rarely find music in the book because people don't touch it anymore. Or you rarely find alarm clocks because everybody wakes up with their phones. So
wow, now this proves how old I am for those two things. Okay.
I'm kind of like calling it like future archaeology, like creating a time capsule of the things we used to have back in 2014 or 15.
And that book was a huge success, and you've now adapted this for Everything We've Heard. You know, so this is a different way of curating. Instead of them curating, this is people in the public eye, you're curating their stories for them. Tell us what the idea was behind this part of the project.
This part of the project started by the idea that the success that the book had telling stories just by showing objects, and how, you know, our consumer culture reads so much in an object. We decode things from the brand, the color, the wear, the style, and how you can tell so many things, you know, beyond that. And also that it didn't need translation. It worked globally. You could put a photo and everybody understands it. So I started to believe in the platform, in the idea of using this as a platform to tell wider stories. So everything we heard came as an idea of, like, is it absolutely true? No, it's everything we heard. And also, in this case, I did Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. It wouldn't be fair just to let them tell us the story, because so many things can be manipulated. So it was a good way of mixing a little bit of everything. The most important aspects of the campaign, the great slogans, the views, the passions, the anger, the accusations, the endorsements. And it mixes the important and the irrelevant, you know, like, and the things that we as people want to know. Like, is the hair real? Are they ill? What do they read? What they eat?
You know? Well, I feel very lucky, actually, because I've got your Donald Trump apparatus, your sort of Donald Trump kit. It reminds me actually a bit, for our listeners, of a kind of model airplane kit, right? It looks a bit like...
Yeah, or also there's things when you probably didn't have them, but I was stealing them off my sister. There's things where you're able to dress up the dolly with, like, paper cut-out clothes and, like, attach them a little, like, fold-over things on the shoulders.
Yeah. No, I did have them, Andrew, but I am an only child.
Okay.
So this is almost like, it's almost like a kit, isn't it? Almost,
yeah.
of things that Donald Trump would have touched, might have thought about in his day. So I've got a shotgun, I've got some golf clubs and golf balls, I've got some G-strings.
Yes.
I've got a video of The Apprentice, and I've got some hair dye and various things. I've also got a toupee at the top here. So these are some of the various things that this is very much you, as Andrew's saying, you have curated this. You've put these things in his head and on his head.
Yes.
Okay.
So tell us some of how you found... Why did you decide to find a real toupee? Have you decided that it's probably fake what's on his head?
Because I read so much about it in a way, like... Do really people care that much? So many questions asked about, and there were interviews to, you know, hair surgeons coming and talking about it. So it was a way of representing the importance of the topic as it captured people's imagination.
And there's quite a lot of food here as well.
Yes, and he's known for eating, you know, junk food and fast food, so you will find...
Although, like, you've let him have a little bowl of cereal at the top of it.
I did. He talked about the cornflakes from Iowa, that he likes a lot.
Okay, the vote-winning cornflakes. Okay, from the cornflake belt.
And all you need to build a wall as well, I see, down in this corner. This is obviously in respect of what his suggestion was he'd do with Mexico. Yes. You've given him the bricks and even the spirit level.
Yes, I've done everything, like if he was going to build it himself. And also around the cheese strings, you have the sweets that he said that he takes before approaching the ladies. I don't know if you heard the
Oh, no, because I wonder what they were. I thought they were some sort of confetti that had fallen out of the knickers.
Yeah, on the video with Billy Bush, he talked about it.
Okay, yeah. That's definitely sexy. Andrew, what have you got in front of you for Hillary there?
Well, I've got Hillary. You've certainly found some nice pantsuits.
I did. I mean, there was a lot of research finding this.
Yeah. I'm sure, because they're exactly the right colour and they have the right kind of brooch and everything. Was it a bit of a task tracking down the right kind of pantsuit in London for...
It was really hard, and I found it on the place that you wouldn't expect it. I did. So I didn't find it on the usual place.
Louis Vuitton.
Yeah, he would have gone. But also you have the rainbow colored scrunchies that she was, fashionably accused of using scrunchies, and she was laughed for doing that. It has a lot of references to Beyoncé and Lemonade.
And Adele too.
And Adele.
Yes, there's powerful women. There's black power here.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has the story of the hot sauce in my bag. When she was asked what she carried on her bag, Hillary said that she carried hot sauce. And that was a big story because...
H-shaped pizza. What's the story behind that?
It's the political campaign that has spent the most money on pizza. Apparently $9,000 have gone on pizza during the campaign. And also some pizza place in New York made her a pizza with the shape of the campaign and with a lot of chilies and hot sauce for her.
So, Paola, is there? I mean, we've got, and you've also, we should say, there's a kind of really fun composite image, which is both of them on one sheet here, one contact sheet. Out of some of these more assuming items or unassuming items on here, what have got the best stories? Like, what were the weirdest things to find, or what are the things that perhaps there is the greatest leap of faith between the object on the page and the thought in your head that was going through it?
It was a lot, and it was a really challenging exercise. And, without getting into the kind of like the political side of it, in one side you have a character, him, which is so in your face. The stories are out there and they are like so visually outrageous in a way that it's easier to build the character. And then on the other side you have her, which is, who is much more reserved, and it's difficult to try to build a visual image of someone like that. I think, like the stories, I love the stories of the, ashes to ashes, dust to side chicks, that, it's a quote from Lemonade and, also talks about side chicks, and Monica Lewinsky was tweeting about that quote. So it was great, to find a T-shirt with that slogan to bring into the photo. There are some little locks around, trying to talk about if there is a secret, they are there. It has all the books that Hillary reads, which also have really nice stories about why those are her favorites. And they all talk about, feminism and empowering and balancing ones, work life and family life. And, in Donald's, we have the strings that we took, and we have the sweets. We have a folder with tax returns that says fragile. And likewise, she has 30,000 emails on the hot sauce in my bag photo.
And tell me, you've worked as an ethnographer, as a futurologist, you've taught design courses, and I can see how all of those passions lead to this extraordinary work that you've been doing. But interestingly, there's a negative side to this as well, in a sense that, as you're right, we have so focused on what's Hillary wearing, what does Donald Trump do in his private life, that in a way, there are no policies here. There are no politics. There's no belief that spills out on the page. Your images are also a bit of a criticism of us in a way as well, saying, come on, guys, you've been more worried about whether he eats, fast food, and whether she eats an avocado for breakfast, rather than focusing on the true policies that will, in the end, decide how the world will be governed over the next few years.
Exactly. And this is the US election that I lived, the closest. And I don't think even so that we ever got so close to the characters in that way. And they have become brands in people's heads. And they, these are the questions that people ask themselves when, going through the candidates. And I think they're very distracting, in a way. And I think that they reflect, in a way, our collective imagination of how we are experiencing things and how much hope and fear we put on those items. The gun, hope, fear, you know, like all those things. And people, of course, have different views about what they see. But they read so much about the stories and they stay on the surface of that. And, you know, there are some references, but I think the image itself says a lot about how we interpret things these days and the cues that we are looking for.
Well, we only have a couple of days to work out which one of these images is going to be for a president and which one for a loser. I know what I hope. But after this, more people in your eyesight, would you like to do Theresa May? Would you like to do Renzi? Who would you like to do next?
Please, no, I love to get into politics. I love to do a day, a Brexit day versus non-Brexit day, and, you know, how your life would be limited to some items. There are so many things that I want to do. And also, I think the contrast is interesting because in a week's time, you know, one of these people will be kind of forgotten in a way. And what they meant with regards to the other one will be also forgotten. So it's a way of capturing, this is Hillary, what she means to our eyes if you compare it with him, vice versa. So I think it's nice to capture that tension and what the election meant that way.
Well, Paola Zuccotti, thank you so much for coming back. It's your second time here on the Monocle Weekly. Yes. We like that. And we hope there's a third time too. And we're going to be back right after this.
Without looking at your scripts, Andrew, how many editions of the Monocle Weekly have we done?
383.
Wow. Can you imagine? Another one bites the dust there. I enjoyed today's programme. Very sort of Italian-themed programme.
Yeah, good accent.
Paola Zuccotti and Mimi Mollica and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And Dejan Sucic.
Yes. Who apparently grew up speaking Serbo-Croat at home.
Didn't we all? The phone lines are going red. He's an interesting person, and I can't wait to go to the. Have you got an invitation? I'm worried that I might not have an invitation to the Lash Up to celebrate the Design Museum.
I've got it.
Have you?
Yeah, I've got it.
Cool. Okay.
Right, you first copy
locked,
mine.
Got that on lockdown. I think that would be a good one as well.
Yeah, I think it's going to be exciting. That building is amazing, and they have used the amazing British minimalist architect John Pawson to do the building. So I'm really intrigued to see what it's going to look like. And yeah, Dejan, yeah, a great interview, and it's fascinating to hear his take on what. Yeah, this shouldn't just be a museum. This is a place where you go and design is presented to you in a much more accessible, interesting way. I recommend people pick up his book. And Mimi Malika's nice, eh?
Isn't he nice? I didn't realise what an emotional sort of homecoming it was going to be. I didn't realise you were the person that made him an editorial photographer a few moons ago, let's say.
I know, it was very nice, wasn't I?
Yeah.
And he's a good hugger.
He gave me a really long hug. I'll just point out to our listeners, when Mimi walked into the studio, he hugged Andrew like a long-lost brother. But for a good... It was over a minute.
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. He's got good knitwear as well, so it felt very comfortable.
When he was hugging you, just between the two of us, what sort of face were you making? Were you kind of wondering if it was going to end? Were you kind of making
At first, I didn't think it was going to end, and then I realised I was really enjoying it. I kind of relaxed
you
into it.
You sort of went into a little sleep.
Yeah, I was like,
and then by the end, this, it's
and
fine.
Then I, with a bit of kind of cashmere rubbing up against your cheek, it's like, ooh, that's nice. I was happy. There you go. So thanks, Mimi.
Very nice.
Made my day.
Fantastic photographer. Great book. King of hugging, Mimi Mollica.
King of hugging, there you go.
Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco and Tom Hall and researched by Maria Khan. And our studio manager, who was that?
Claire Urban.
Of course it was. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.